Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Rental housing has long been a neglected policy area of our national housing policy, which has instead focused almost exclusively on promoting home ownership. But in cities and in towns across Malaysia, there's a significant portion of residents who are tenants, who for various reasons rent rather than own the housing unit in which they dwell. Now, what are the challenges that renter households in Malaysia face? And how might policies better support those who rent for whatever reason, out of choice or whether out of necessity? Joining me on the show, Fikri Fizal, is Fikri Fizal. He is a researcher from the think tank, The Centre. He is also the lead author of a three-part research series that sought to explore the experiences, challenges and aspirations of renter households in Malaysia. Fikri, thank you for joining me on the show today. In looking at your research series, I noticed that you argued that greater attention is needed on Malaysia's rental housing policies and on renter households. I thought maybe we could begin there, start our conversation tonight by perhaps describing what you see as Malaysia's housing-related policies and its approach towards renting.
Okay. Hi. Thanks, Melissa, for the invitation. Really appreciate it. Okay. So not many would be surprised when I say that Malaysia's housing policies for the past several decades have focused more on promoting home ownership rather than renting, which is quite standard in Asian or Southeast Asian countries. So in the past, like right independence, the government's priority was to provide quick shelter, quick temporary shelter to solve the squatter after housing problems in urban areas, particularly in KL. That's why you see like in that period, there were a lot of PKNS homes built, for example. And then it moves on to the government shifted its drive towards developing new townships, new neighborhoods through Urban Development Agency, UDA, and then through GLCs. And now we see mostly the private sector leading it. So there's a two-tiered market, we can say, to summarize the Malaysia's housing market. For the low income, it's social housing, your PPR homes and so on. For the others, the middle income, the high income, it's the housing stock is mostly provided by the private market with minimal government intervention. And that stance, that attention towards promoting home ownership, it extends till today. So today you see like Prime Minister Ismail Sabri announcing one family, one home aspiration and a lot of financing schemes that I'm sure you've heard of, like the home ownership campaign, for example, right? It's always owning homes. So
yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, there has been a significant skew towards home ownership orientated policies. But what impact does that have of decades of policies, a policy bias towards home ownership? What impact has that had on the rental market? And I'm asking because it feels that renting is seen to be like a temporary phase in a person's life, you know, or it's how you live if you can't afford or are not ready yet to own. It's always in relation to ownership, but it's been neglected. So how has that impacted the rental housing market?
Right. So the simple answer is the impact of that decades-long policy is renters are neglected in the space of policy making. We still don't have a renting specific law. We've talked about it, the proposed Residential Tenancy Act. Rizal Marikan has talked about it. Before that, Zuraida has talked about it. But details over its timeline, over its provisions has never been clearly stated. So what this means for renters is they are faced with several aspects of insecurity. They are open to a lot of discriminatory or unjust practices by landlords. They cannot have a long-term security in the place where they are renting. you know, there's always the possibility that they may ask to move out if the owner sells their homes and so on.
Right.
So renters are faced with a lot of insecurity due to these long-term policy slant towards home ownership.
Okay, so clearly that there's been a blind spot when it comes to policymaking in our housing sector. Fikri, when you did your research series, you also highlighted that there is a sizable number of what you called hidden renter households. Could you explain more about what you learned in your research about who rents, about where they rent, and why they're renting?
Okay, so on paper, it looks like a lot of Malaysians own homes. We have Dawson's data in 2019 says that around 79%, the home ownership rate of Malaysia is around 79%. 76.9%, which is quite comparable to
quite
other
high.
Quite high when compared with high income economies. When compared with ASEAN countries, it's comparable. I mean, Singapore is close to 90%, but that's a special case lah. The US 65%, Germany 50%, Switzerland 42%. So when you compare with those countries, yeah, it's quite high. But that's on paper. When you zoom into a certain locality, which is, let's say, Klang Valley lah, a very urban region, right? And you zero in on a certain income threshold, B40, M40. Then you can see that when you zoom in like that, approximately half of B40 and M40 households in Klang Valley do not own homes. So in Selangor and KL, B40 households own in Selangor 52%, in KL 45%. M40 in Selangor 65%, in KL 51%. So that's approximately half. So half, the other half, either they rent or they live in quarters or with their family members. So national home rate looks, it looks like a lot of people own homes, but in the Klang Valley region, a lot of them do not own homes. So this is why we urge policymakers to shift more attention towards rental policies, because there are a lot of people renting in KL, especially the lower income threshold.
Why do you think that is? Is it just because housing is just unaffordable in areas like the Klang Valley?
You might hear other reasons being offered by other people, but honestly, my personal opinion is, yes, I would say that's the simple reason. Houses are unaffordable. Ben Negara said a household needs 8,300 ringgit per month to afford a 300,000 house, which is the affordable house designation. And less than 76% of households earn that amount. So yeah, it's a simple problem of affordability. However, having said that, then the question becomes, but the government has created a lot of affordable housing programs. You have PRIMA, state government has Rumah Selangorku, federal territories have Rumah WIP, some are priced lower than 300,000. Why are they not being taken up? Because another important factor which we found in our survey, quite surprisingly, is the main factor for most respondents is not affordability, it's location.
Oh.
Right.
Location, meaning that is why they've opted to rent as opposed to buy.
As in, that's why they chose to rent or to buy a particular property. So if you build cheap houses at some 2-hour away location from city center, it wouldn't solve the problem, because as much as affordability matters, location also matters. Even amongst low-income group, where affordability-related factors do matter more, location is still not relegated to the lower ranks. But amongst higher income, let's say 5,000 and above, according to our survey, is purely location. I will decide to buy a house or to rent a house because I like that location and its offerings. Yep.
Oh, okay. That's quite interesting. If location has emerged as a crucial factor in the decision to rent or to buy, then do you think, given, and I speak for perhaps looking at the Klang Valley, do you think then there is a policy blind spot of addressing, say, rental housing policy within the larger urban housing agenda? Are we factoring the fact that, you know, almost half of the denizens of the cities dwell in rented dwellings as opposed to their own housing unit. And what that might mean for an urban housing agenda, the way we're planning our cities, we're planning the way we live and we work, is that enough data? Is that enough policy focus on this, in your opinion, Vikri?
I wouldn't be bold enough to say we have enough data to prove it, but at least we have data that indicates this is the case, which if a larger, you know, a survey with a larger sample size can confirm that assumption, then it really has to policymakers really need to rethink the whole easy financing home ownership campaign thing, because yeah, like especially people of the younger generation, millennials and younger, it looks like it may perhaps look like they want something accessible physically, geographically. They want something convenient and not necessarily just want to sign an SPA in some remote locations. Yeah.
All right. Is it a fair assumption to say that the majority of renters are from a younger generation?
So we did work with a data survey company, Datel, for in part one, which if you scroll to the bottom part, that's where we talk about it. So in terms of, let's start with region first. In terms of region, of course, mostly in Klang Valley, 41% is of the renters are in Klang Valley. And the other regions, it ranges from 26% to 38%. So, okay, it mostly in Klang Valley, but other regions have their fair share of renters as well.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of age, yes, not surprisingly, it's the younger respondents tend to form the majority of renters. According to this survey that we worked with Datel, close to 40% fall between the ages of 20 and 29.
Okay.
So for the old, but having said that, even let's say, let's take 50 to 59 years old, that's a significant 26%. So, you know, yes, younger people tend to rent more, but it's not to say there's little percentage of older people who rent.
Right. This is quite fascinating because, again, it really is quite a neglected area. We often don't think about the welfare of renters and renter households, particularly if they are from the lower income bracket. Can I ask you, you pointed out in your research about cost burdened renters, which of whom these households, they spend more than 30% of their income on rent. What is concerning about this category, and what has been done to maybe alleviate some of the burden that they're carrying?
In terms of national programs, I don't think we have any, because a lot of rental programs, well, you see, whatever rental, public rental programs that we have, it's the whatever you can see in Lembah Pantai, you know, those PPR complexes, which face their own types of issues, density, connectivity. And it's very limited to a small number of the population, very low income threshold. But the fact of the matter is that now, middle-income people also need assistance in terms of housing. And it doesn't have to be only ownership. It can be assistance in terms of rental programs, right? So, especially in the Klang Valley, KL's B40 threshold nowadays is close to 8,000, I think.
Right.
So we have sporadic rental assistance programs. We have, like, state government providing their own programs. Kementerian Wilayah, their own program, Zakat bodies, their own program. So that perhaps makes it less efficient in solving the problem as a whole. And if the scale is larger to a nationwide scale, perhaps that would be more effective.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more on this topic. Stay tuned. Hi, thanks so much for staying with me on Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. I'm speaking tonight to Fikri Faisal. He is a researcher at the Centre, and we are looking at Malaysia's policies on rental housing and rental households. Fikri, when we look at other countries that have been successful in making renting a more viable and secure practice, where should Malaysia take its cues from? And also, more importantly, if we are looking at those countries, can those policies be feasibly implemented in a local context?
Thanks, Melissa, for the question. So there are, there are several examples we can look at. For good tenant rights and security, we can look at Germany and France, which are typically viewed as renter-friendly countries. So for in both countries, for example, your tenancy agreements, they last longer, at least 6 years for certain types of houses. So that's not the case in Malaysia, right? It's usually 2 years or sometimes even 1 year. So when you have that long of a agreement, you will be more secure in your tenure. And then there's also automatic renewal, you know, so you don't have to like renegotiate with your landlord every time your agreement expires. It's automatically renewed. It only expires if either party terminates. And then if a landlord wants to evict a tenant for whatever reason, you are only allowed to do so under certain circumstances. If the tenant abuses the contract, or if the landlord wants to sell the house, and even so, there's a 6-month notice period. So it's a very, very rigid procedure that favors the tenant. For security deposit management, you can look at Victoria State, Australia. They've just created a new bond authority, which is a third party that manages your security deposit. So when you move out, the body will straight away return the security deposit to the tenant. And if the landlord wants to dispute that, not deduct the deposit for whatever reason, he can bring it to the tribunal. So the point being is that the landlord cannot just simply deduct deposits for whatever reason he feels fair. Yeah.
So all of these policies are about, as you said, providing some security, or as favoring the tenant, allowing the tenant security, correcting that power imbalance. Why do you think there is a power imbalance in Malaysia? I mean, if you were to hazard a guess, what makes the state favor the landlord over the tenant?
Well, it's usually implied, not only in Malaysia but globally, that landlords hold more power over tenants, which is why some countries took the initiative to create laws to protect tenants, realizing that fact. But I guess we don't need to like conduct an extensive study to realize like landlords tend to have higher income / wealth by the fact that they're able to own properties as compared to tenants, who many of them, not majority of them, perhaps didn't choose to rent but have resorted to renting due to some factors. So that is why it's important to protect tenants, because if you're a low-income tenant and you're asked to evict in 1 or 2 months, you are uprooting your life. You know, that's the cost of transportation, the cost of logistics to move your things, to find a new school, things like that. So it's landlords don't have to face that. Landlords face risk as well. We don't deny that. But the risk that tenants face is far more aggravating than the risk that landlords face.
You mentioned the Residential Tenancy Act that a little bit earlier in the conversation. What do we know about how that might better protect tenants, and why has it stalled? What is the progress so far? Do you have an update?
I don't. That's the short answer. The latest update is the ministry wanted some feedback, so they I think this is 4 months ago, some months ago at least, this year, definitely. So they called they requested the public, whoever, individual institutions, to submit feedbacks online. So I think they got 6,000 responses, which I'm not sure how they will go through every response. Senyap. So no idea about the timeline. I'm not sure why it stalled. Maybe there's a fear of backlash prior to the election. That's my guess, but no idea.
Right. When you were doing the survey, I find this quite interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found with the respondents? One of the reasons I'm asking is because often when we see chatter on social media, we hear stories or personal experiences of people who have been discriminated against when they are looking for rental housing. And that has also kind of deterred people from seeing renting as a sustainable long-term practice. What were some of the interesting findings that you had when you spoke to some of the respondents in the survey about their aspirations and the kind of, the challenges essentially in the rental housing market?
Right. So discrimination in when dealing with landlords is not something new. You read about it, you hear about it, especially on Twitter threads, right? And it appears, and our survey also found the same thing, it appears to be more prevalent amongst the Indian community. Others, not so. So that's it's not surprising. It's something we've heard for a while. And in terms of when we ask respondents what would encourage them to consider to rent long-term instead of buying a house, number one, the most cited factor is pertains to that. They want more protective regulations introduced for tenants, which include anti-discrimination laws, but not only that, it also includes the safe guarantee of security deposits, of well-defined tenant rights. So that's the most cited factor. The second most cited, which is chosen by 73%, the first cited study was 77%. So 73% say they would consider long-term renting if there were more affordable renting programs introduced. So we're talking about building more public rental housing. We're talking about giving out more rental subsidy and rent stabilization measures. So that seems to be the main priorities for.
Okay, those are
quite legitimate concerns, and almost all of them have to do with, that those are only ways the state can intervene. Those are policy interventions at a government level. What is it that you think policymakers should focus on? What is the role of the state in ensuring that renting is also a viable option for those apart from home ownership?
That's a big question. Because it forces you to answer what is the role of the state in promoting or even empowering renters. That's school of thoughts, lah. For some. They would say the state's role is just to leave it to the market. You've heard about this a lot of times. Mm. There's also the state should provide the proper legal protection to provide tenants enough protection. And for some, the state needs to do more, which is to assist renters in affordability. So that's where building house, public rental houses come into play, limiting how much can a landlord raise their rents, providing subsidy to renters in terms of cash, in terms of vouchers, so that sort of thing. So that comes down to how the government sees itself. Personally, I would say the government should at the least, provide the legal framework, because that protection is sorely needed, especially for low-income renters. Yeah.
Right. Fikri, thank you so much for joining me on the show today and sharing your research with us. That was Fikri Faisal, researcher from the Centre, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.